Wow. I'm thrilled to be here. I had an opportunity to speak here 5 years ago. It's great to see old friends that I haven't seen for years, and so I was thrilled at the opportunity to come here and address this issue. I mentioned that my title includes the phrase Republican Empire, which is a phrase coined by Alexander Hamilton. Now, I'll have to speak a little bit about Alexander Hamilton, but I hesitate to do so because in the audience is, of course, from my standpoint, the greatest expert on Alexander Hamilton that has ever written on the man. Of course, that's Forrest MacDonald, who may or may not know it, but he influenced me to write on Hamilton, and is one of the reasons that I, you know, have a Hamiltonian perspective on things. But it puts me in mind of the story of the man who survived the Johnstown flood. And he one of the very few survivors and so forth. But this was the defining moment of his life. And for the rest of his life, he went out, and whenever he talked about the Johnstown flood, any opportunity he had, talk about the Johnstown flood. And finally, you know, he died, and living a good life, you know, he found himself at the pearly gates and was permitted entrance. And St. Peter said to him, well, you know, showed him around a little bit. And he said, you know, we always have for the newcomers, we have a little discussion group, and we get, you know, you get to talk on something to the, you know, to the people who are already here. And the guy said, well, you know, I'd like to talk about the Johnstown flood. And St. Peter said, well, okay, but you have to realize that Noah will be in the audience. So, I always feel that way when I'm, you know, talking to an audience that includes Forrest MacDonald when I'm talking about Alexander Hamilton. But I also have to say this, you know, I am at the Naval War College, and we have this sort of ambiguous situation. We do have a great deal of academic freedom. You know, if you read my stuff, probably know what that you know, it's unlikely that I would get away with that anyplace else. On the other hand, I do have to, you know, add the disclaimer. So here's my disclaimer. The opinions expressed here, while correct, do not necessarily reflect the view of the War College, the Department of the Navy, or the Department of Defense. Okay. When he was elected to the American presidency in 2000, George Bush gave clear indication that he, like his father before him, was a conventional realist in foreign affairs. Committed to a grand strategy of selective engagement and critical of the open-ended nature of the Clinton Doctrine and its indiscriminate use of the military force in instances not involving vital national interests. In his speeches, Bush stressed foreign policy retrenchment and military transformation. In preparation for the emergence of a future large-scale competitor along the lines of the Soviet Union in the Cold War. Neither Bush nor his advisors, most notably National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice or Secretary of State Colin Powell, spoke of spreading democracy throughout the world. Then came 9/11. To the surprise of almost everyone, the president abandoned his realism and embraced an approach in foreign affairs that seems to be nothing short of revolutionary. The Bush Doctrine was first enunciated in a speech delivered on the 20th of September 2001, only 9 days after the attack, and then refined and elaborated in 3 more speeches over the next 9 months. Writing in the September 2004 issue of Commentary, Norman Podhoretz identified 4 pillars of the Bush Doctrine. The first is the unapologetic assertion of the need for and the possibility of moral judgments in international affairs. The second is the repudiation of the social work theory of terrorism, the belief that economic factors, poverty and hunger, are the root causes of this phenomenon. In contrast, the Bush Doctrine is founded on the contention that the terrorism that spawned 9/11 and its precursors, both against the United States and Israel, is a murderous ideology that desires the destruction of Western liberalism. This ideology is every bit as dangerous as Nazism and communism. The third pillar of the Bush Doctrine is the right to undertake what in the past has been called preventive war. While international law has always acknowledged the right of a state to launch a preemptive strike when an attack by the latter is imminent, this did not hold for preventive war. President Bush argued that in an age of globalization, catastrophic terrorism, and weapons of mass destruction, this distinction had become meaningless. If an attack had become imminent, it was too late to do much about it. The fourth pillar is the treatment of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian Arabs in the context of the war against terrorism. President Bush is the first American president to officially endorse the idea of a Palestinian Arab state. But the establishment of such a state is contingent upon the repudiation of terrorism on the part of the Palestinian Arabs. Another name for the Bush doctrine is primacy. Primacy is based on an international relations theory called hegemonic stability theory, which holds that a liberal world order does not arise spontaneously as a result of some global invisible hand. Instead, such a system requires a hegemonic power, a state willing and able to provide the world and with the collective good of economic stability and international stability, security. The United States, as Great Britain before it, took up the role of hegemon not out of altruism, but because it is in its national interest to do so. Now, primacy can be caricatured as a go-it-alone approach in which the United States intimidates both friend and allies, wields power unilaterally, and ignores international institutions. But the United States pursues what can be characterized as a benevolent primacy, one that is in keeping with its liberal political traditions, but recognizes the world as a dangerous place in which peace is maintained by the strong. This form of primacy is based on the assumption that the U.S. power is good not only for the United States itself, but also for the rest of the world. The argument that the United States can be fully secure only in a world where everyone else is also secure. The existence of liberal institutions is not sufficient. Such a world order is possible only if the United States is willing and able to maintain it. In the words of Sam Huntington about 13 years ago, he may have recanted since, but he had it right here. It was, the maintenance of U.S. primacy matters for the world as well as for the United States. Continuing, a world without U.S. primacy will be a world with more violence and disorder and less democracy and economic growth than a world where the United States continues to have more influence than any other country in shaping global affairs. The sustained international primacy of the United States is central to the welfare and security of Americans and to the future, freedom, democracy, open economies, and international order in the world, unquote. According to the theory of hegemonic stability, the alternative to U.S. power is a more disorderly, less peaceful world. The precedent for the United States is the decay of Pax Britannica, which many believe created the necessary, if not sufficient, conditions for the two world wars of the 20th century. As British hegemony declined, smaller states that previously had incentives to cooperate with Britain defected to other powers, causing the international system to fragment. The outcome was depression and war. The decline of American power could lead to a similar outcome. Now, for better or worse, the Bush Doctrine is now inextricably linked to neoconservatism. Now, interestingly, as far as I'm concerned, since you see it loose use so indiscriminately now, it's really hard to say what it means anymore. I saw in the New York Times the other day that William Buckley was described as a neocon. But I think actually our speaker last night, Andrew Bacevich, has one of the best workable definitions or descriptions of neoconservatism. This is from his book on the New American Militarism. He said the purpose of the neoconservative enterprise is to fuse American power to American principles, ensuring the survival of those principles and subsequently their propagation to the benefit of all humankind. Now, it is an understatement to observe that the Bush Doctrine has generated a great deal of criticism. Now, much of the criticism that comes from the left is simply a manifestation of Bush hatred. We know that. As one WAG has noted, these same critics would heap opprobrium on Bush even if it was revealed that he had discovered a cure for cancer. Okay. The more, I think, competent and the more telling critique of the Bush Doctrine is from the political right. And we've seen that with Jim's presentation and with Andy's last night. And there's a new book edited by Gary Rosen called The Right War? And where he talks about some of these things. He says in there that the debate over the Bush Doctrine on the right represents the most interesting and consequential discussion of U.S. foreign policy taking place in the United States today, and I think that's correct. Now, in addition to the neoconservatives, he posits two other schools here. He says, two conservative foreign policy One of first is The Realist, of course. Now, in this particular book, they're included by people like, represented by people like Henry Kissinger, Owen Harries, Robert Ellsworth, and Dimitri Symes. And then he calls what he calls the traditionalists, which include Patrick Buchanan, George Will, Andy Bacevich, and James Girth. Realists stress the importance of power and military security in international affairs and are most concerned about maintaining a stability and a peaceful balance of power. For the realist, the state's most vital interest and its only meaningful goal, no matter its form of government, is to maintain sufficient relative power to ensure its security. And insofar as they are the heirs of Hans Morgenthau, realists also reject the crusading spirit, eschewing ideology and defining the state's interests as narrowly as possible, making it less likely that they will come into contact, into conflict with the interests of other states. Realists reject the Bush Doctrine because they claim it endangers real U.S. interests. For instance, in his recent book, Taming American Power, Steve Walt argues that the problem with the Bush Doctrine is not primacy per se, but the way in which the Bush administration has pursued it. According to Walt, the Bush approach has been counterproductive, creating a serious backlash against American power on the part of both enemies and friends. The traditionalists, as you've heard both last night and from Jim, reject the Bush Doctrine, among other reasons, because they believe it violates American Republican principles, and that ambitious foreign adventures such as Iraq damage the American politic. According to Rosen, the traditional view reflects, quote, the instinctive desire of many American conservatives to stand apart from the seemingly distant, corrupting affairs of other nations, a position motivated in part by a belief in American exceptionalism, but also by fears about the size and reach of the federal government, unquote. The essence of the traditional conservative perspective is captured by the title of one of Buchanan's books, A Republic, Not an Empire. Now, the problem for the realists, I think, when it comes to the Bush Doctrine, is that the dire consequences they thought would be engendered by the Bush Doctrine have not come to pass. For instance, there has been no anti-hegemonic balancing, not even the soft variety, which is the fallback position. This suggests that the realist practice of dismissing regime questions, which according to the reductionist logic of structural realism, doesn't matter. In other words, it doesn't matter whether it's democracy or something else. All states are essentially equal in the system. That when you reject that, when you don't pay any attention to that, then your theory is a little too parsimonious, as they like to say. By ignoring the differences between a liberal democracy such as the United States and other states, realists miss the point that apparently even countries unhappy with the Bush Doctrine don't really believe that Bush and the neoconservative cabal that Walt claims has hijacked American foreign policy on behalf of Israel, if you probably read his little paper they did it with John Mearsheimer, that countries don't really believe that the United States wants to govern vast areas of the world by force. These countries also see the need to confront radical Islamic terrorism. If one of the goals of a theory is to predict behavior, realism has come up short with regard to the Bush Doctrine. Now, from my perspective, the problem with the traditionalist view is that it mistakes the vision of Thomas Jefferson for that of the founders as a whole. In their view, there is no room for Republicans' vision of a Republican empire. Now, an early version of the debate between today's traditionalists and neoconservatives took place in June of 1787 at the Federal Convention here in Philadelphia. On the 25th of June, Charles Pinckney of South Carolina asserted the predominance of domestic policy in a republic. And this is a long quote here. We have unwisely considered ourselves as the inhabitants of an old instead of a new country. We have adopted the maxims of a state full of people and manufacturers and established in credit. We have deserted our true interest, and instead of applying closely to those improvements in domestic policy, which would have ensured the future importance of our commerce, we have rashly and prematurely engaged in schemes as extensive as they are imprudent. Our true situation appears to me to be this: a new extensive country containing within itself the materials for forming a government capable of extending to its citizens all the blessings of civil and religious liberty, capable of making a happy at home. This is the great end of Republican establishments. We mistake the object of our government if we hope or wish that it is to make us respectable abroad. Conquest or superiority among other powers is not or ought not ever to be the object of Republican systems. A couple of days later, Hamilton replied to Pinckney, and he said, "It has been said that respectability in the eyes of foreign nations was not the object at which we aimed, that the proper object of Republican government was domestic tranquility and happiness. This was an ideal distinction. No government could give us tranquility and happiness at home, which did not possess sufficient stability and strength to make us respectable abroad." Now, both the realists and the traditionalists reject the Bush doctrine's emphasis on expanding liberal democracy, mocking this enterprise as muscular Wilsonianism. But the expansion of like regimes can be found in Thucydides, who noted that an important goal of both Athens and Sparta was to establish and support regimes similar to their own, democracy in the case of Athens and oligarchies for Sparta. Indeed, the Bush Doctrine endorses this very Thucydidean perspective. As the President declared during a June 2004 speech at the Air Force Academy, "Some who call themselves realists question whether the spread of democracy in the Middle East should be of any concern of ours. But the realists in this case have lost contact with the fundamental reality. America has always been less secure when freedom is in retreat and more secure when freedom is on the march." And I think that Bush and the neoconservatives understand that like Thucydides, that the security of a state is enhanced when it is surrounded by others that share its principles and interests. Let me just stop by remarking that while the content of American foreign policy is important, we cannot and never should forget the rule of prudence. According to Aristotle, prudence is the virtue most characteristic of the statesman, and it's concerned with deliberating well about those things that can be other than they are, in other words, means. In foreign affairs, prudence requires the statesman to adapt universal principles to particular circumstances in order to arrive at the means that are best given the existing circumstances. So we cannot say with any certainty whether or not the Bush doctrine will succeed. But critics of the doctrine should note that adherence to a particular theory has never been a guarantee of its success. In the recent past, American foreign policy has been informed by realism in the case of Richard Nixon and a form of traditionalism in the case of Carter, and both can be said to have been failures. The Bush doctrine also will fail if it is not applied with prudence and blessed with a certain amount of good fortune. Thank you very much.